His book that has just come out, Finding Murph, in regards to, of course, Joe Murphy. Rick, good to have you back on the show. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. I really appreciate the chance to talk a little bit more about the story both of Joe and, you know, some of the other NHL-related issues that I try to uncover in this.
So, you know, Joe Murphy was the number one pick in 1986. He was the first college hockey player ever selected first overall in the NHL draft. And then, of course, he won a Stanley Cup with the Oilers 4 years later as part of the kid line. You know, had a pretty decent career, was a point-a-game player 1 year with 82 points. You know, there was like when you talk to him, was the hit, did everything change, or is it too simple to say it was one hit? It had to be a combination of more than one hit, no?
My sense is that it was a string of hits, and that in, you know, during the time that he played, and more recently since then, he was just right back out on the ice after an injury. You know, whether it was a trainer saying, "Are you good to go?" and the player nodding, "Yeah, I'm good to go." That pressure that guys feel like they have to be in the lineup, and the real hesitancy, I think, from NHL medical staff to keep players out. I can't remember the last time, I don't know if you guys can, the last time that you heard that an NHL team trainer or doctor was going against the wishes of the player and the coach and saying, no, he can't play. Can you recall anything like that?
Are you talking about publicly?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, has anything seen the light of day about something like that?
Well, I guess, but, you know, how many times have you heard it maybe not go, or is it go said and not be released?
I don't know. I just know that the media in all these NHL markets are pretty darn good at their jobs. And if there were cases like this, that you would think that it would come out over the course of the years. And I look pretty closely at this. You know, I just didn't find that to be the case very often. Like you guys said, Joe's career in Edmonton was really interesting. He came over, you know, when he was drafted number one overall in 1986, there was a real debate over whether he or Jimmy Carson should be taken number one. And right from the moment that the Detroit Red Wings selected Joe Murphy, it felt like they regretted that choice. And they wanted the local boy, an American, Jimmy Carson, with a Greek background, just like the team owner. Felt like the odds were stacked against Joe. And he really did play his best hockey in the NHL in Edmonton. And it was really fun to do a lot of reporting on that Oilers team. You know, talking to guys like Jeff Smith, a local kid coming in, and just hearing his memories, forget about Joe for a second, what it was like coming in as a rookie on that Oilers team. And in the way, you know, I remember him describing it, talking about how his dad would come in and you'd have Kevin Lowe and Mark Messier saying, "Mr. Smith, can we get you a coffee? How many sugars do you take? What kind of cream do you take?" Really, really amazing leadership on that team. Smith told me, I remember he was eating Kraft dinner for dinner a lot. He was making about $90,000 a year. And Mark Messier, like he did with so many young guys, would say, "My door's always open. Come over for a steak." And that was, from what I'm told from many guys who played for the Oilers in that era, a real gathering point, Messier's downtown condominium. So, you know, really interesting story about Joe with a lot of ups and downs. And I really tried to portray him, you know, as a real person, somebody who has flaws like we all do, someone who's made mistakes, someone who's being held accountable right now by the decisions that he's made because of his current circumstances.
When you look at, you know, you went through in detail his life, was there, you know, maybe it's a bit much, but was there a point where it was like, you know, things really started kind of unravel for him? Was that during the NHL or post-career when things really started going sideways for Joe Murphy?
Well, I think it was, you know, it started going sideways when he was in the NHL. There was one hit in 1991 when he was coming out from behind his own net with his head down, and Sean Burr, a Detroit player, caught him, and Joe says fractured his jaw. And he just kept playing. He was off the ice for a few shifts, but was back in the game and really didn't miss any time. And so how do you get through that? How do you keep playing a sport like hockey when you've got a broken jaw? And the answer was painkillers. And we know that he's far from the only player who has turned to painkillers. to try to stay in the lineup. And then he leaves the NHL in 2001, and as some guys do, kind of falls off the radar. You don't really know where Joe Murphy was. But the truth is, he was self-medicating and trying to find a way to manage through, you know, a lot of the pain that he was still feeling. And I don't know if you guys saw the documentary that we did called The Problem of Pain on TSN a couple weeks ago. But again, this is not, do not think of this in the context of, well, this was a 1980s and 90s problem. Guys in the NHL today are still grappling with this. What do? Can they try CBD? Can they not? NHL teams aren't encouraging it. And NHL teams, according to the players that we had on camera, are still not warning players about the long-term dangers of taking, you know, some pretty powerful drugs like Toradol and anti-inflammatory. So NHL is a great game. I love hockey, and I feel like I have to say that every now and again. But the truth is, this sport, which is in good times a $5 billion industry, whose commissioner describes the NHL as a family, it can do better for active players and retired players alike. I think most people would agree with that.
Rick Westhead joins us, TSN senior correspondent. His new book is out. It's called Finding Murph. Of course, it's about Joe Murphy. And, you know, I think it was a few years ago where, you know, the story kind of came out. Joe was homeless. He was basically living in a bush. And some had said they'd reached out. He didn't necessarily want help at that time. But from my understanding is recently he's changed his tune on that. Is he getting help right now, Rick?
No, my understanding is that he's moved further west. Again, my information's not new as of today. But okay. He was in Regina over the course of the summer, and CTV, their affiliate, did a story interviewing Joe in Regina. And I don't know if he wants help or not at this point. I really don't. It's interesting, too, guys. I mean, people think, my gosh, an NHL star are homeless. This is not the first time it's happened.
No.
You know, Derek Sanderson was a wheeling star in the NHL in the 1970s, and I interviewed him. I wasn't too familiar with Sanderson's story. This was a guy who quit the Bruins and joined the Philadelphia Blazers in the WHA. He would be on late-night talk shows like Johnny Carson and Merv Griffin and Dick Cavett. He once bought a Rolls-Royce Phantom with cash and was known to burn $100 bills in a local nightclub just for the fun of it. He wound up homeless as well. And he told me the story of how when he was sleeping in Central Park, other homeless people there would give him advice about how best to use a newspaper underneath him to try to keep him drier at nighttime. And again, Sanderson isn't the only other player as well. One of the things I do tackle in the book are all the different anecdotes through the decades of players who have struggled. And the truth is, in 2020, the NHL can't tell you, well, this is an isolated situation, there's only a couple guys, because they don't know. And the reason that the NHL doesn't know is because it's never invested in trying to understand how many players how their former players are doing. What's the mental health of retired players? What's the physical health of retired players? Not once has the league invested in a survey or study to get answers to that question.
So, you know, to just kind of figure that out, would that be the next step or a step for in your opinion, to try to get a handle on this and maybe a better idea of where all the players are and how they are doing post-career?
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to know the scope of the problem, right, if you want to address it. And that, to me, that's the low-hanging fruit. The few times that this has come up through the years, one of the reasons that, you know, that it's not been pursued has been this belief that, well, if we start doing that and we start tracking the mental health of retired players, could that impact the employability of active players? I think that's a bit of a reach. But nevertheless, don't we owe it to the wives of players and the children of players and the players themselves, just to know how they're doing and where they're at and how this league and teams, how they can help these guys in a better way.
So I actually would look at it a different way, Rick. I think it needs to be as they're going in. I think as they're going in, there needs to be some conversations with them and the league and perhaps the third parties talking about, you know, what can happen when you get in the league. And I, that's talking recreational drugs. That's talking all the things you're talking about here with head injuries. Cause I think, you know, getting the information before, as a player, I know I had a couple of pretty good talks with people as I went in, and I learned a lot from those talks. And they would have served me a lot better before than would have the information after. So I think it's as you go in. But those are tough conversations to have with people who feel like they're bulletproof at 20 or 25 years old, whatever the age is.
It's interesting you say that. You know, I talked to Ryan Kessler about this, and I also talked to his wife, Andrea, about this. You know, and her perspective was she'd love to see the wives of players have maybe not a voice, but at least be more involved in the process.
Sure.
Understand, you know, what kind of painkillers their husbands are being administered and what they are and what they do. You know, I don't know. Does an 18 or 19 year old, are they going to be able to take in and absorb and really get, you know, the subject matter like this with an advisor maybe. But from my experience, most guys who just come in the league, they've spent the better part of the last 5 or 6 years focusing almost exclusively on junior hockey, on getting to the NHL.
Sure.
So the lessons about, hey, here's what can happen when you're in your late 20s and early 30s with anti-inflammatories, I don't know that that's the best time for that conversation, but it's absolutely a conversation that should happen. Maybe at the start of every season. Like you pointed out, the NHL does talk to players about drunk driving in their fall tour and about the dangers of social media and recreational drug use. Why not throw in an extra 15 minutes each year to remind guys about their brain health and about, you know, the dangers of painkillers and playing through concussions?
What about as far as the role of agents in this?
I was just going
to
say the same thing.
To me, you know, agents, I think, you know, I had a good agent and he was there for a long time, but where are they in this role of protecting their clients if there is an injury?
I don't know the answer to that. There's a lot of certified agents in the business. I've heard from some players who have, you know, agent who have had agencies and hired agents who have hundreds of clients, and other guys whose agents only have a few. And there doesn't really seem to be a common thread in terms of, well, this agency is amazing. Everybody's got a checkered record. And, you know, I would imagine if you've got hundreds of players at an agency, if you're an agent with at least a couple dozen active guys, pretty tough to stay on top of all your active guys, as well as the guys, the next generation that you're recruiting, and making sure that you're trying to help the former players who are struggling. That can be a pretty time intensive process.
Well, here's my thought on this. I entered Joe Murphy in 1986. The world's completely different then. A, there was no internet. B, you know what? You know, the Players Association, nobody had the power. Here we are in 2020. Like, as a parent, you should have the conversation. Like, at some point, isn't there a little bit of responsibility on the adult themselves to know and their family members to be like, hey, you know what? These are some things. Have you read about this? Have you read about that? Like, and I agree with you. The agent, like, to me, that's their job. And rather than have an agency of 200 clients, if you can't service your clients properly, then don't get new ones. Right? Just
Absolutely.
Focus on the ones you have.
Not to put words in your mouth, but you're basically saying, where's the accountability on players, right? And their families.
Yeah.
You don't think Joe Murphy's being held accountable right now for his
decision? No. But I'm not talking Joe. I'm talking about the current crop, because Joe Murphy didn't have the opportunity that today's athletes have, because a lot of this stuff is available to him. Him and his mom probably never even heard of it. They didn't even know about it. Right? So I think I'm not saying Joe is a victim, and I'm not ripping on Joe Murphy. I'm saying for today's, like, to compare what happened to Joe Murphy to today's player, I think is different, because today's player has more of an opportunity to educate themselves.
Yeah, it is different, but still, Joe has to be responsible. You know, he ultimately, and I talked to him about this, and we cover it off in the book, I mean, he made the decision to take the painkillers that he took.
Yeah,
and
fair.
He made the decision to get back in the lineup before, you know, his symptoms of concussion cleared. So he is partially responsible for where he's at today, but he's not the only one who's responsible. And I think that's the point I'm trying to make, is that in my opinion, there's shared responsibility and accountability on this. So, the other thing I find interesting going, and I'd love to hear your impression of this. The other thing I found interesting, going through some of the meeting notes of NHL general managers through the years, help me understand this. You have a cohort of GMs most of whom are former players. And when the issue of brain injuries and concussions and player injuries on the ice is brought up, you have examples of guys, of general managers saying, we shouldn't bring the stretchers on the ice so soon. It looks way too dramatic. Or midway through the season, I don't know about all these guys clutching their head when they're getting up after they've hit their head in the corner. I think maybe they just want a couple weeks off. Can you help me understand the perspective of a former player who's now a general manager? Where could that belief come from, that guys would be faking brain injuries and that stretchers should not be brought on the ice at an NHL rink because it's too dramatic?
Yeah, I would like to think that's just a one misguided opinion in a group of 31, because if it's not, that's a real big concern. Right? Like,
I agree.
Like, I would hope that that's the anomaly in there. But the fact that it's happening, you're right. I think, like, hockey, I've always talked about hockey is so worried about ever letting anything get out there that they then will hurt themselves by not getting pertinent information out there to their players, to their players' families. Because, you know, Ryan Kessler's wife has a good point, but, you know, I don't know when they got married, but a lot of guys come into Stretty didn't get married till he was late in his career, right? So what, if you don't have a wife when you're 19 or 20, you know, that only really helps certain groups. And you can get a concussion, last I checked, as a rookie, as a second year, as a third year, just as much as a 15-year veteran. So, you know what, part of it's on the players. I like what you said, Rick. There's everybody's got a little bit of accountability, and there just needs to be more open lines of communication.
Here's the thing. The NHL is a juggernaut business. I just talked about how much money's in the game. They can do better. The medical teams for these NHL teams are among best in class. So this is not like you've got to reinvent everything. Be open and honest about who the concussion spotters are in each of your NHL rinks. Just do it. There's no harm in it. Educate players on what happens if you take Toradol through the course of, you know, the playoffs on a daily basis. Stop guys from taking painkillers, you know, in the preseason. Why would you be taking a Toradol injection in a preseason game or in a game in September or October or in a regular season? Some of these things I just think come down to logic and empathy.
Yeah, I really like that. It's well said. Like, do you really need to play that game and Toradol? It's, you know, that's one. NHL has kind of talked along. Oh, we don't have a drug problem. We don't have a drug problem. Maybe you didn't have a cocaine problem. Maybe. But if you have a painkiller problem, the long-term effects are just as damaging for some guys.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. I mean, Patrick O'Sullivan's a guy I've talked to. You know, when he was in the NHL, he talked about how the team trainer walked up and down the aisles of the charter jet with a paper bag with meds, handing them out. Kyle Quinn, and this is not, again, these are not unique stories. Kyle Quincy, the former Red Wings defenseman who we had in the problem of pain, one of the clips we did not use in the story was him talking about playing in the American Hockey League with Grand Rapids. And how in that locker room before games, the team trainer had a tray of supplements and drugs and would walk around saying, do you want to play good or do you want to play great? So you can have a great agent. You can have parents who are fully invested. But honestly, do you think a 20-year-old playing in the American Hockey League or 21-year-old is going to share that kind of information with their agent and their parents?
Yeah, no, that's very well said, Rick. I look forward to reading the book. Where can people get it?
It's on Chapters Indigo. It's on Amazon, and it's in any of your local bookstores. Really great chat. I really appreciate you guys for this. Thank you.